You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today our guest is Dave actually I should have checked, sorry, is it O'Brien?
O'Brien.
It is Brian.
I was a donkey, I don't even know him nationally.
Okay, that's fine. O'Brien, okay. Okay, so hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today our guest is Dave O'Brien, the President and CEO of Stuhini Exploration. So hello, Dave. Welcome onto the podcast. How are you?
Oh, I'm fantastic. Thanks so much for having me here. I look forward to this podcast.
No, it's great to be talking to you. We've got a few things that we can cover. You've told us you had 40 years of investing in the stock market, and of course you're now running Stuhini. So there's a number of things we can talk about on this podcast. So looking forward to it. Of course, Kenny joining from Scotland. I don't want Kenny to get too distracted on this podcast talking about salmon fishing, because I know he enjoys fishing a lot. And also you are a fisher, but welcome, Kenny.
Yeah, it's great to be back on, Mark, and welcome, Dave. Yeah, I'm sure we can touch on salmon fishing at some point, because it's part of your life story, so it's only natural that we can talk about it. But it's good. We've got quite an international podcast. We've got Vancouver, Scotland and Holland. So the wonders of technology today brings us all together, huddled round laptops. So it's like I say, it's great to have you on. And maybe for the next 10, 15 minutes, Dave, the floor's over to you. Tell us a bit about yourself, where you grew up, you know, what it was like growing up, and how you get into the world of investing. And, you know, obviously the salmon fishing is a big part of the story as well. And ultimately now you're at Stuhini Gold. And obviously you've got quite a few opinions on gold and the monetary systems as well. So we'll let you speak for a while and we'll jump in as and when.
Oh yeah, I was born in Montreal in Eastern Canada, and my family wasn't French. And in the late 60s and early 70s, many Canadians that weren't French left Quebec, because there was some problems back then. There was some separatist movements. And I was just a little kid in the statistic, but many, many people left Montreal. And we ended up in the suburbs of Vancouver. And I was very fortunate to grow up that area, because we had, the rivers were still, the population was much smaller back then and had the growth. And there was salmon in all the local creeks and streams. And I had a wonderful upbringing in the suburbs of Eastern Vancouver, and I went on to university, studied mathematics, and I when I got out of school, I had a lot of options available. Being a statistician, of course, actuarial science was where most of my classmates went to. I also taken my securities course, considered being a broker, but back then Vancouver was, well, it still is, but it was very it was unscrupulous, and it wasn't the best place to invest. And Toronto was where you wanted to be. I did not want to leave Vancouver, because the fishing was my first love. I was also did a 5-year program, so I nearly completed my master's degree. I had that opportunity. And then, I decided I'd probably pursue actuarial science. I was doing some consulting work, and I found out my local fly fishing store was for sale, and I didn't really have much money. My father wasn't a rich man, but his house was paid for. And I, bless his soul, he put a mortgage on his house and lent me $100,000, and I put some investors together and bought the local fly fishing store. And I really was quite lucky. A year after I bought the store in 1990, or maybe it was 2 years later, River Runs Through It was published.
Oh, yes, great film.
Our motto was, who parked the bus in front of the store? I never really viewed myself as a businessman, but suddenly I had a thriving business and a booming You know, it used to be in the 80s, you go to a party, and if you found someone to fly fish, it'd be a blessing. And, you know, later on, 10 years later, you know, there'd be 5 or 10 of us sitting in the corner swapping fishing stories, right? So, and it's allowed me to, and I've learned a lot about business. Running retail is a tough business, and you're only as good as your people. And I'm really blessed right now because of a wonderful, you know, staff in the fly fishing store. And my manager he's my boss, you know, he does a great job. But it's allowed me to pursue my venture capital dreams as well. And you know, got involved in junior mining and investing, and, you know, made a lot of mistakes back then. I was even pre-BREX in the 80s, late 80s, but a really tough market. I remember things were really, really tough. I was going to school, but I remember Earl Murray Pesman in Vancouver and this SK Creek discovery. It's called Prime Resources and Consolidated Stikeen. And these stocks went crazy. And there was Murray Pesman was such a character, you know, back in the day. And we were playing the markets back then, and of course didn't know much, but just we thought, you always, the worst thing you can do in investing is you buy a stock at the beginning and you make money because then you think you're smart. Yeah. I think that might be similar to a lot of these young people nowadays buying all these, you know, altcoins and bitcoins and what have you, that you need to go through some storms in the market and get wiped out a few times to really learn how to invest and be really, really cautious. And if there's one thing I hope we can, you know, parlay to the readers is being cautious when you're buying mining stocks. There's great opportunities, but as Ernest Hemingway once said, all of mine is a hole with a liar standing on top.
Yeah.
So, you have to be careful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've had my fingers burned many times. In fact, I mean, I walked away for 4 or 5 years because it just pissed me off that much. And I just thought, you know, I'm not going through that emotion again. But you are drawn back in. So, yeah, you know, there's opportunities and, you know, people you've known from 10 years previous and you see them doing well. So you do get drawn back in, but like I say, you're 10 years older, you're a bit wiser, and you certainly have had plenty of time to reflect on the mistakes, or particularly that I'd made. And most of my mistakes were just, we say in Scotland, Billy Big Balls, where you just go, you know, the percentage of your portfolio is just so overweight in one stock, and all it takes is for that stock to, you know, to crash, and that's you, you know, you're chasing after that, you know, and that's as simple as it is. Sometimes that's how it happens. You know, a few suspended shares and, you know, your portfolio is absolutely smashed. So yeah, no, I can share that pain with you. I've definitely been burned a few times, but I've come back stronger for it. So it's, yeah, you need some failures in life, definitely.
Oh, yeah. Well, and the nature of venture capital, too, you know, you people have to realize what you're getting into. Like when I buy a junior mining stock, you can buy a junior mining stock, you're really looking for, make, you know, minimum, you know, 3 to 5 times your money. You're really ideally dreaming about a 10 bagger, and you're not looking for 10 or 15% gains. We have to be patient, too, right? I mean, the best companies I've ever bought, I never bought them at the right time. I always bought them a little bit early, you know, and then you may be a little average down, a little bit patient. But those are the real, real winners I've had. It's hard to time the market. And the big difference in investing and speculating, and you try and take the speculation out of it by investing. You know, you have to, what I've learned to do over the years is value project valuation. That's really how I make my living. Yep. And understanding that when you, like Ross Beattie's a famous, you know, Vancouver financier, and you buy stuff when it's out of favor and it's cheap. And he went to South America in the late 90s when no one cared about copper. I mean, copper was in 27, 28 cents a pound. You know, BHP had laid off their entire exploration staff. One of the chairman is Dehaney, Tony Fograssi. He was a, you know, some of these people were passionate geologists, but there's no work. They went back to school and studied law. And I know three, you know, lawyers / geologists whose love is geology, but there's no work in the late 90s. They went back and got their law degrees. And it was very interesting. And then the greatest thing about resources is the best solution to low prices is low prices. Of course, you know, copper is sitting at 27 cents a pound, and Ross Beattie was able to buy these massive projects in South America with the old 1.5 and almost 2% grades. They don't exist anymore. And then, of course, you know, China was emerging, and 3 or 4 years later, copper had to move to $4 a pound to spur the next, you know, exploration bout. Yeah. And these he made a fortune on these companies, and that's how I, you know, try and model a little Stahini. We were able to buy a big molybdenum project, you know, 5 years ago when molybdenum was out of favor and no one cared about it for, you know, it's a 450 million pound project that's probably worth about $10 billion, able to buy it for a couple of $1 million in shares of cash, $2.5 million. And that's how you make money. And you'll be patient too, right? And now molybdenum's woken up considerably. And our asset has gone from, you know, $3 or $4 billion asset to a $10.5 billion asset. We believe is economic now. Certainly the mine was under construction back and got rallied by the 2008 financial crisis. And what it is, and I remember back in 2008, I was helping to finance a bauxite deal in Cameroon, Africa, and we had an incredible deposit. It was a multi-billion dollar deposit, but boy, those markets just froze right up and went south. Everything just died, and a bit of a wipeout there too.
Yeah, it's interesting the way that the cycle's going. Obviously now we're in the middle. Well, I don't know. I don't know if it's a super cycle or, you know, it doesn't feel like a super cycle. It feels like something different because, I mean, I know you like talking about this, Mark. This is more your kind of thing. You know, it's this whole green energy EV revolution just seems different. So it does. It feels different.
It feels different. Yes, I was doing a podcast or a chat with people and I sort of asked the same thing as the next mining super cycle. And the kind of consensus was maybe not a mining commodity super cycle, but certainly the whole green and EV base metals. So, yeah, your copper, your lithium, your molybdenum, your graphite, your nickel. We could see a super cycle, but certainly a very buoyant time for those ones. But yeah, global kind of mining super cycle. They were of the opinion that perhaps, you know, I don't know, maybe that's not where it's going to be. So when you say it's a little bit different, then I would, yeah, maybe kind of mirror those feelings. I certainly feel that there's going to be an awful lot in those battery and green clean economy metals coming along, as we'll see new opportunities for companies in that space as well, not just mining for them, but companies operating projects in that space. Well, I don't know what's your feelings, Dave. Do you believe in a mining super cycle?
I think we're in I believe the commodities, you know, includes oil and gas, you know, precious metals base is a great way to play inflation. You know, when now we have inflation, which we won't be able to, it doesn't look like we'll be able to stop it. You really think that the Jerome Powell raising rates to 2% is going to stop inflation? I think it's a fairy tale. So it's a great way to buy tangible assets that are undervalued is one way to do it. But I don't like buying into these, you know, like people phone me up right now and they ask me, what do you think of uranium stocks? And I'm like, well, I think uranium's a great space, but the stocks have already moved up tenfold in most cases, right? You don't want to chase hot sectors. You want to buy sectors, in my opinion, when they're out of favor. You know, things, even for example, molybdenum is, you know, the World Bank recently stated that, molybdenum is a critical green metal going forward. And that and copper, they singled out as two of the most important metals because it's so many different uses. But you want to get into the party when no one knows about it. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're reading about molybdenum in the paper 2-3 years from now, it's probably too late, right?
Yeah.
And it's like Bitcoin. Everyone started talking about $65,000 and all over the news and celebrities are talking. It's too late. The party's already left, right? And, you know, it's like someone said to me last year, when a fellow CEO was telling me, we're going to go to Newfoundland. And you know, and I go, why are you going to go to Newfoundland? I go, why would I want to go to Newfoundland and pay millions of shares and millions of dollars for a project that someone staked a year ago for $5,000. We have to be the ones staking. So in other words, try and be ahead of the curve and don't chase these hot sectors. Try and vision, you know, get be there. That's how you invest. Yeah. I like copper. Okay. Copper is a great metal going forward, and do your homework. And you want an early stage project where you have maybe it's a big upside, but the drilling just started. You want a project that's more advanced. I believe there's two of the most important things when you're buying a junior mining company. There's two things you really got to, you know, watch out for. Number one is management. It's the most important thing. You have to know and you have to trust management. And number two is make sure they have something you can actually bite your teeth into. I mean, you saw someone who's hit on a drill hole and they're waving their arms and saying battery metals and nickel and everyone's jumping on. I mean, that's not close to being a resource. You know, you need hundreds of holes to actually make a resource. And then it starts getting to your risk. And then you can compare that resource to other new resources. So understand what you're getting into. Like if someone's got a couple of chip samples, they're probably 4 or 5 years away from even a feasibility study if there's, you know, that 1 in 1,000 of those chip samples turn into a resource. Mm-hmm. And so understand that. And when I buy junior projects, I want to make sure the resource is already there. A lot of it's drilling. And I want to buy a project whereby, you know, let's say a little junior gold exploration company where they spent $40 million defining a resource. And I can buy that company for $5 million. And I understand resources. It's economic. It's in a good jurisdiction. And there's a good jockey running the show who's not stealing from shareholders and having steak dinners every night or pretending they tried hard, where, you know, the money's going to the ground, the salaries are very, very reasonable, they have a lot of skin in the game. Well, these are the same old, you know, things, but you want to be careful about that.
Yeah. You've been investing for 40 years, you said, didn't you? I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, one, there's the research of the company, but this idea of staying ahead of the curve or one step ahead of the crowd, finding the things that are unloved. Where do you start with that? I mean, you're almost taking a bet on the future, aren't you?
Well, like, for example, right now, people say, where are you putting your money? I'm buying quality, you know, gold and stock, gold and silver stocks, mainly producers. I'm finding producers trading at, you know, literally less than 5x earnings and trading way below book value. And I've been buying the in situ resources for, you know, for example, $10 an ounce. And again, I'm buying stuff because it's out of favor. It's unloved. And I love it. When people talk about how poorly the gold stocks are doing, I'm loading up. And that's sort of how you have to think, right? You have, and the thing is, even when just as it starts to get a bid, everything, you're already sitting on a double or a triple already, right? When the main people start moving to that first phase, the early money's already made the big money. And again, I'm very careful, and I speak with management and I dig deep into projects. And even though I'm not a geologist, I have geologists that work for me, and I've literally been involved in geology for almost 40 years in geology too, because if you're going to invest in a mining company, you want to learn some basic geology, and you have to know the difference between an epithermal deposit and a porphyry deposit, bulk tonnage deposit, and you really want to know those kind of things.
Yeah, so there's a certain amount of them when you think you found what is the unloved commodity or idea for the time being that you want to get in early. You've then got to do your research on the company. You mentioned the board, and of course a project you can get your teeth into. But do you also really have to, as a private investor, do you think, understand different deposits and understand the grades that are coming out or have come out to really help you make a good decision?
I don't think you have to know it completely on that level, but you do have to, you know, have your definitions and, you know, what you want, you know, and understand valuations, right? For example, you know, if you look at the cycle from 2002 to 2007, that was an amazing commodity cycle. Back then, projects traded at 10% of in-situ value. What that means, if you've got a billion-dollar resource, 10% of $1 billion, $100 million, the company's trading at $100 million valuation. Nowadays, companies trade at 1% of in-situ, which is much, much cheaper and much more attractive. Back in those days, you know, if you had a million ounces of gold in the ground, and people didn't really pay that much attention to what type of deposit is. Is it a shallow deposit, is it a deep deposit, is it high up in the middle of nowhere, is it, you know, road accessible? You bought gold back then for $100 an in-situ ounce, and gold was trading at $700 an ounce. Now we have gold trading at $1,800 an ounce. I can find companies trading at $10 per in-situ ounce, right? So understanding what, these are resources, and then when I look at the deposit and say, okay, it's trading at $10 an in-situ ounce, it's in gentle terrain. There's mine. You can build a mine there. You're in a good jurisdiction like Canada or Australia, even Africa. You're a premium, and understand that it looks like an economic deposit, right? Especially if there's mines nearby that are similar grades. You need some comparables and things like that, right? So that's really important.
Okay, yeah. And you said when you're looking, or anyone really who's looking to investing in junior miners, you're really looking for, yeah, five, really 10x, like a 10-bagger. That is the big win, isn't it? That 10-bagger. Could you maybe share? You've mentioned gold, you've mentioned silver and copper, molybdenum as commodities. What any other commodities you're looking at the moment? And, you know, perhaps can you give us any idea of some of perhaps your stock picks?
Yeah, well, as far as commodities go that I'm looking at, again, I'm very bullish on the precious metals. We can talk about that a bit later. I think that right now with the inflation scenario we have, gold shouldn't be at 1700, 1800. It should be more like 2300 or 2400. Mm-hmm. Silver is a very similar argument, but what we can talk about is a completely different subject. So I'm looking for gold and silver stocks. And what I find about this market right now is that it's not properly priced in the sense that I can find producers. I'll give you an example. I really like Superior Gold in Australia, or Galani Gold. GG is a symbol in Galani. And these are producers like Superior Gold, you know, is an 80,000 ounce a year producer. Typically an 80,000 ounce a year producer will sell, you know, have a $400 to $500 million market cap. These guys have a market cap of $100 million. And they've got some tremendous upside. They've had some spectacular drill results down deep, and they're drifting to those areas that the Indian zone where the grades are higher. And they have an NPV5, an open pit right next to them that has a net present value with a 5% discount, trading at a value worth more than the entire market cap of the company. They've got an idle mill there that's worth maybe $100 million as well. And then you add everything all up and you come up with a, you know, $300, $400 million valuation. You buy that for it. And it's a producer with positive cash flow. And the same about the Galani Gold, another one I really like. It's you know, they've got the Mopani mine in Botswana that's been operating for years, and just on that basis alone, they're usually trading with a 5x of earnings. But their key assets are Galaxy mine in South Africa, whereby they're now ramping up production, But a 2.5 million ounce deposit that now the mine's built going into production typically is worth, you know, several hundred million dollars. And this is a company worth less than 100 million. And yet there's companies in Canada that have had two drill holes in the ground that are maybe 10 years away from ever becoming a mine, valued higher. And it makes no sense, right? Buy the companies that are earning the money, that have money in the bank, and that don't have to dilute, and for much, much less than you would for just an exciting exploration story. And this is where I think there's a lot of opportunity in the market.
Yeah. Sorry, Mark. Yeah, just when you're talking there, Dave, your story reminds me of, I don't know if you've came across Nova Resources that were...
In Australia.
Yeah. It was conglomerate gold. And I seem to remember they done a live stream of, I think it was guys out with a metal detector, and they were taking nuggets out of the ground. And I think within, you know, this company didn't have an ounce of resource at all. I think within about 2 months, it was at $1 billion, the valuation of the company. It was just crazy. Not a single ounce of resource, yet it was valued at $1 billion. There's some really mad stories out there. So there is. I think they just got really fortunate that when they were live streaming, I think it was at a conference or something, that these guys hooked out some nuggets from the ground. And obviously, conglomerate gold's very nuggety anyway. So, and it's very hard to get drill results that you know, they can be a bit hit or miss. So, yeah, it was a strange one, but I think there was a lot of money made and probably a lot lost as well along the way.
Sure, that was one of that really brought Quentin Henning to fame, that project there. He helped deal with that sort of a paleoplacer type gold situation, quite unusual actually. And I've invested in some Australian. I mean, certainly I like Superior Gold. I've talked about that, and Carrara is another nice one. Australia is a good jurisdiction. I think it's a good jurisdiction, and there's some undervalued companies there.
Why do you think it is now? This is a kind of bizarre thing that all the Australian companies are mining in Canada and all the Canadian companies are mining in Australia. It seems very bizarre, doesn't it? That, you know, that not saying the vast majority, but an oversized percentage of mining companies in Canada are Australian and vice versa in Australia are Canadians. I don't know how that came about, if it was just by chance or I don't know. You've been around a wee bit longer than me, Dave, so maybe you've got some comments on that.
Well, yeah, the Australian market is a little more like the Wild West. You know, it's like the CSE where the rules aren't nearly stringent. So I've seen some Canadian companies delist from Canada and go to Australia, and I maybe for some unscrupulous reasons, I won't get into that, but I've seen some assets. See, the worst thing that can happen to you in the mining sector, it's happened to me a few times, why I'm a shareholders' rights advocate, is management will literally try and steal a deposit from shareholders. They'll realize it's a good deposit, and they'll drive the company into the ground and then force it to merge with one of their companies.
Yeah.
And you know, they'll give it lousy management, make sure it doesn't have a good, successful path. So they can downplay the asset, roll it into their company, and then suddenly we find out what a great asset it is. And I've seen that happen time and time again. We could go on and on and on about all the scams I've seen over the years, but there's a lot of bad people out there. And you know, the way to run a business is simple. You put the shareholders' needs ahead of your own needs, and you make sure you're a big shareholder. And that's how you do it, right? And it's pretty simple. And not, again, it makes you pay for your stock. You know, I'm not talking about cheap shares for debt or a bunch of half-cent founder stock or drive the price down to nothing and take a bunch of options, like all the old games, right? You know, you should be in every financing. I think CEO should be writing checks. There's a lot of their own skin in the game. I mean, real skin too. Like, you know, and ask somebody, if you're talking to a CEO, and say, well, how many shares do you have and what do you pay for those shares? Like, right from your founder stock, right through your seed rounds, like, what's your share structure? And it's important to understand that, right? Then you find out, oh, I paid, you got 12 million shares, you paid a half cent a share for, and he wants me to pay 50 cents. That's not a business proposition, right? That's a promotion, right? As Rick Rule says, and he's very true, right? And, you know, we're putting together some deals right now, and the guys want to have a half cent founder stock. I go, no, I want 5 cent founder stock. Right? It's more reasonable, and we want the big money to come in. They're going to appreciate that down the road.
Yeah, definitely. I must admit, I know we've not gone to Steeny yet, but I did notice from your website that I think your highest salary was $2,000 a month, Canadian dollars a month. So that's a big tick in my box right away. You know, if you're
When I designed Staheen again, I'm a businessman from the real world where you know you count your paper clips and every penny counts and there's no public money and you don't dilute, right? And I've done, you know, my business is my fly fishing business is iconic. I'm proud of that. They say it's the top fly fishing business in all of Canada and one of them in the world. And my partner, Barry Hanslett, the co-founder of Stahini, his drilling companies, you can eat off every drill. You know, our businesses are very well run, but they're private. And I really think that sometimes it's badly needed as well as, you know, people from the private sector that know how to run a business that didn't have that experience. Just because you're a bright geologist, you really know how to run a business and create value. That's important. And then like, you know, I kind of view the junior mining system as a bit of a broken system. If you have three management groups, three senior people in management wanting six-figure salaries, wanting to draw, you know, $120,000 a year in salaries, then you got entertainment meals, and they're out at, you know, the keg every night having steak, and they're going to hockey games and running bar tabs and all that kind of stuff. And there's no money left to put into the ground, you know, and then the marketing budgets on top of that. That's really important. Every $1 million a company raises, how much is actually going into the ground? And something I'm really proud of is a couple of years ago, I called my CFO, Yana. I said, Yana, how much did we spend at our Ruby Creek project and our Cube project in the Yukon this past year, the last 6 months? And she sent me a summary. It was $972,000. And I said, what do we pay management? And it was $25,000 and change. And I did the math. During that six-month period, it was a 37.5-to-1 ratio. And what that meant, for every $1 we paid management, put $37.50 in the ground. And I'm sure that's some kind of a record. And I've been criticizing my salaries too low. And yeah, $2,000 a month is perhaps unrealistic. But you have people out there running shells where the company's dormant. And they're accruing $120,000 a year where there's no work. You have a week's worth of work to do for the entire year. And then what they'll do is 2 years later, they'll roll that $240,000 their own in their stock at 5 cents, do shares for debt and get paid for it. How can you justify charging a shell those kind of fees, right? I see that time and time again. And you got to realize that's what you're dealing with, right? So, again, I think a CEO should probably make, you know, $60,000-$70,000 a year top, something in that range for a small little junior mining company. Once your market cap reaches a certain level, we sort of, our corporate governance ethics committee would say that we should be paid, you know, the bottom 25% of companies with that sort of market cap, right? And that's sort of how you want to look at things.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, as you said earlier on, you know, you've got skin in the game. That's where you're going to make your money, Dave. You know, $60,000-$70,000 Canadian dollars a year is not going to make you rich by the time you take off the cost of living, etc. So yeah, I definitely, that's one of the things I look for when I'm investing as well. You know, how much, you know, skin in the game has the CEO got, and how did he get those shares? Did they pay for them, or did they award themselves? You know, so it's definitely a big factor when investing. But I just want to jump on you. Obviously, you've got a kind of love hate with the gold and the monetary system. We talked about it before the podcast. You know, you're a big gold fanatic, a gold bug. You collect it yourself. And you've got very strong opinions on the international monetary system.
Yeah, I think investors have to know how the whole system works. And there's so much. I see stuff out there in writing. I just shake my head. I recently read a comment that comparing why gold was down. And a writer, this is a claimed journalist, claimed that, well, obviously the convenience of gold is the convenience of money is much more appealing than the awkward convenience of owning metal, which is why no one wants gold. And what they don't get is money. You know, the Bank of England created notes, so you don't have to pack around gold and silver. And really, you know, the U.S. became this great country, like from 1776 to 1971 on a gold standard. And a gold standard simply, you know, governments can't run deficits if they live within their means. We all know that if you let governments free spend, they'll eventually spend themselves to oblivion. And we have 6,000 years of history that again and again and again. And we're watching history being repeated. And you know, people say, oh, you know, gold became irrelevant when the Americans went off. They went off the gold standard in 71 because the system didn't work anymore. They couldn't pay their gold. They couldn't pay their bills. And they needed to leave that system because they were spending beyond their means. And really, in the mid-50s, when America peaked, they had 25,000 tons of gold. And as they started fighting the Cold War, and as they started fighting Vietnam, their gold drained. And by the time the late 60s came along, they were down to supposedly 8,000 tons. And that's when Charles de Gaulle made his famous speech about that there can only be one currency, and that's gold. And to bet against gold is a bet on a country. And 6,000 years of history tell you that's wrong, and always bet on gold. And now the U.S. wants us to believe they went off this gold standard, that their dollar is safer than gold and sacred. And they're printing like crazy, and the whole Western world's printing. And it's just grade 4 history being repeated, and we don't understand what's happening, and you have to protect yourself. And I think the gold's a huge threat to the dollar. I mean, the day that the Reddit crowd said they were getting the silver, why was the whole Robinhood app shut down? And then a week later, when Danny Ellen made comments, she never talked about the silver. She talked about GameStop. And it was all, I predicted overnight, it happened at 2 p.m. our time, the markets are closed. Like, the Americans will never, encouraging the American public to buy gold and silver is like allowing China to invade U.S. territory. They want to keep their dollars sacred, especially now when they have so many bonds to issue. I mean, they're printing money, and according to E.B. Tucker, they're buying 40% of the bond issue. So people have to be aware, and how do you protect yourself? And I truly believe that 10% of your worth should be in gold and silver, and you really should own physical metal. You don't want to buy paper metal, because we all know how it's going to end. You're going to think someone owes it to you, and there's not enough there. There's very little gold on the planet. There's a 21 meter by 21 meter by 21 meter cube of gold. And the planet's been scoured three times over. It was scoured in the late 1800s and again during the Depression, and the last cycle really got scoured. So I know up where we are right now that there's very few, you're not going to find mineralized outcroppings anymore. You're relying now much more on geophysics, some clever geologists, some geochem. And because those easy days of finding mineralized outcroppings and building mines from that, those are finished.
Mm. This whole idea of living beyond your means, is the Western word living beyond its means for so long, and just printing money and coming off the gold standard and just printing and devaluing the dollar. Now we have the inflation that everyone's talking about. What is the price that has to be paid, do you think, for that way of living?
Obviously there's going to be a reset coming. I mean, a lot of these economists, they're more supply side economists. They believe in money printing, and it doesn't work. I mean, We had a lot of money. What's amazing when you look at the U.S. system is, when they were still in the gold standard, when there was a trade imbalance, say with Japan in the end of 1967, there's a $70 million trade imbalance. That meant Japan would ship back the $70 million, and the U.S. had to ship the $70 million gold, and there was no free lunch. And when governments run deficits, they lose their gold. And so it's very convenient to go off the system, and suddenly that was the beginning of deficit spending. And look what happened. Back then it was, in the 1970 when the U.S. went off the gold standard, a lot of great economists, that's it. They're in 50 years from now, they're printing money. And a lot of people, how could you ever think to imagine the U.S. printing money? That's absurd. They're the greatest country in the world. But again, look what's happened. They're printing money now. Mm-hmm. They're running not just trade deficits, budgetary deficits. You look at them, you just put it on a spreadsheet. From 2012 to 2019, look at the annual trade deficit for China alone. And every one of those trade deficits on a yearly basis would have, if you believe the 8,000 tons of gold is in Fort Knox, 8,000 tons of gold is only $800 billion in gold. But that was the average trade deficit. Every year after year, they would have drained their gold just on their deficit with China alone, let alone the rest of the world, let alone their government overspending. So it's just a broken system that's, it's now run to the point where we now have inflation. You generally can't stop inflation. The only country that I know that successfully stopped inflation was the U.S. under Volcker, when they rose rates to 21.5%. They had 13% inflation. I was just getting out of high school at that time and starting university. And I remember all the houses got cut in half, and they didn't have the lay they got, but they didn't have the debt back then. And it was a reset. And the only way they could have saved the system back in 2008 is to normalize rates back to 6 or 7%. Maybe let those banks fail and bail out the savers if you have to do, if you believe in that. But savers have to realize too, when you put your money in the bank, there's risks. And then, we know in Canada, we only insured for $100,000. It might have changed, but at each bank, so you spread it around. And people got to be aware of that, but they could have normalized. Imagine if we had normal rates back to normal 6-7%, we wouldn't have these housing bubbles. We wouldn't have the stock market bubble. And I grew up in a system in the 70s when inflation was 7%. I got 9-10% of my savings. You always got 200 or 300 basis points above the inflation rate. And in 1981, government of Canada bonds were paying 18%. What a great investment. And but now here we have 7% inflation in the US, and you're likely to get 1%. So you're losing 6%. And that's very, very worrisome. And even the stock market, if you think, this is the top tier, I made 7%. Well, no, you didn't. Inflation 7%, you broke even, right? So you don't have to adjust things for this inflation. And again, we've had strong inflation for quite a while. A lot of it was hidden in the form of these huge trade deficits of U.S. When the government spends $1 trillion extra, it's supposed to be inflationary. But that $1 trillion is what the U.S. exported every year or ran trade deficits with. So they ship the money literally out of the country, not to cause inflation within the U.S. And then the policies of the 2008 financial meltdown, those aggressive policies, they caused severe asset inflation. We didn't see it in consumer prices, but we saw, the house price of real estate and the price of stocks go up. Because let's face it, if interest rates are 5%, people expect know, 3.5 or 4% yield on a utility or a bank stock. But interest rates are 1%. People are willing to take a 2% yield. When, you know, bank stock goes from a 4% yield to a 2% yield, all things equal, price is doubled. You know, so there's just so much risk out there now. We have ridiculously priced stocks and ridiculously priced real estate, and it's a runaway asset inflation. Now it's spilling over to consumers. And here in Canada, for example, everybody thinks they're wealthy because their houses are worth a fortune, and they're buying new RVs and trying to buy new trucks and trying to buy all. They're you know, using their houses, and it's going to be disastrous.
I think that one of the problems with trying to control inflation with the raising of interest rates is I don't think there's much room to do that, because you start raising that, I think people are going to very quickly see that they can't afford to meet their mortgage payment. And I think I'll ask the question, do you think the Fed is in control? I mean, I think they're stuck in two situations, either try and save the US dollar or in the meantime, effectively, I think cause a big economic crisis, or the dollar fails. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. They're stuck, because even if they raise rates to even 2-2.5%, it'll kill the entire system and we'll go into a depressionary spiral. And this time we'll have a government to rely on because they're broke, right? And be servicing all that debt. I mean, just as a little afterthought here, you know, you can Google this right now. The world economy is $88 trillion. As of February 2021, the world debt was $280 trillion, and Frank Giester recently claimed it was $300. So whatever, incredible leverage, $300 trillion. So when you're looking to see a crane in the sky and building, it's all borrowed money. And those creditors think they're going to be paid back, and they're not going to be paid back. And you're right. If the Americans raise rates to really deal with inflation, you'd probably have to raise them like above the inflation rate, 7 or 8% would be absolute disastrous. The houses would be crashed like you've never seen before. It'd make the depression look like a cakewalk. So what they want to do is they want to pay people back in a greatly reduced currency. If I tell you, Ken, that I'm going to pay you £1 million in 10 years, inflation's 12%, you're going to get, you know, you're going to get 50 cents the dollar if you're lucky. It's 0.88 to the ninth power type of thing, right? So, you know, but they're not going to get, oh, inflation's under control and all. It's going to tell you all these things. Mm. But meanwhile, they're sucking people into my 10-year debt notes for, you know, 175 basis points. And it's crazy when you have 7% inflation. That never existed. So right now, if someone's willing to lend me money at 3% when inflation's 7 or 8, I'll take that bet any day.
Yeah.
You know, these are back in the 70s. You wouldn't have, right now in the 70s with these type of inflation rates, mortgages would be 8 and 9%. We wouldn't have the bubble.
Do you think inflation is going to continue? Inflation is going to continue, but and the Fed will just make moves to make it look like they're trying to control it, but really, that's what they want.
Well, they have to. They have to pay back. There's two choices. Either cause a massive depression and never get paid back. Plus, in those scenarios with the debt the Fed have, you just do the math on $30 trillion debt the U.S. owns. If you were to raise that, you pay 5% to service that. That's $1.5 trillion a year. Well, that's half their revenue. Meanwhile, they're taking in $3 trillion a year and spending 5 and 6 and 7. So imagine coming back from $7 trillion spending a year to $1.5 trillion, which is the reality of the story. That's a government gone. There's no more military. There's no more roads. There's no nothing. And it's just such an unfathomable scenario right now. So, and I truly believe they're not going to tell you, they're going to tell you what they want to tell you. Oh, we're going to have it under control. And it's temporary. Oh, we have to. They don't have any tools. I mean, they had to rate dramatically, even in the 70s when interest rates were 8, 9, 10, 11, but they couldn't kill inflation. You literally have to jack it right up and lay the economy on its back. And there wasn't the debt back then. So it is a broken system, and it's the 50 years are up. You printed all that, you went out of the fiat system, time's up, and people don't realize that. Now we see inflation, they won't stop it.
So what happens then? What when the time's up, you say reset, is it terrible? Is it really bad for everyone?
Well, I think, like, I listened to a guy named Rubino on one of the Sprott interviews recently, and I really like his, I mean, he predicted 2008 meltdown, but he just says that they're going to, you know, people are eventually going to lose faith in the dollar and these type of currencies. They're going to want some sort of a global currency in which governments cannot print, in which there's no sovereign risk, and it's obviously going to be gold related in some way. Now, the U.S. kind of, what the U.S. still thinks is no matter what happens, we're still going to control the entire world economy going forward, and the rest of us are going to go, no, you're the one that blew it. You're the one that left the gold standard and led us to the edge of this cliff here that we're going off right now. You know, and you think all the people around the world that are they're buying physical gold, whether it's India or China and all these savings nations, they're going to allow the U.S. to create a new system when they blew it already? No. The U.S., if they want to keep their dollar, become a backwater, no one will use the dollar anymore. And people are going to want something they can trust that cannot be printed that's backed, right? And that's what money's supposed to be. It's something that's supposed to preserve its value. And again, that's why gold works so well. And you know, under gold standard, not only do governments have to live within their means, but you don't get inflation because no one country is able to find enough gold in a given year to dramatically increase their money supply to cause inflation. In the U.S. Constitution, gold was a 20th of an ounce of gold, or 20th of an ounce of gold, and they stayed that way until really in the 1930s, until they nationalized the gold and seized it.
Yeah, so almost a return to perhaps a gold standard, which I do agree with. And as we said at the start, me and Kenny are physical buyers of both gold and silver. I want to ask you though, where do you think Bitcoin or cryptos come into it in terms of the that blockchain idea, that limited number of coins that could ever be mined? Do you think a digital dollar or some kind of crypto might come into the picture?
I don't really want to talk too much. I think crypto is worth zero.
Okay.
It's just that every day there's 50 new currencies. Someone was telling me about, there's a book called The Death of When Money Dies with the Weimar Germany story. And two years before you needed a wheelbarrow of money to buy a loaf of bread, everyone was bragging about real estate. Everyone was bragging about the stock market. And they were trading currencies in the alleys every day. And then 3 years later, there was basically three types of money. There was gold, silver, and the third most important commodity was coal. I mean, you have to live and you have to stay warm. Mm-hmm. And this comes down to the basics, right? I'm actually buying some oil and gas companies that have large reserves because oil is tangible and it's real and it's very little we need. As much as we want to move to a green economy, we're years and years and years away from that. We have to be realistic.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about this all night, Dave, because obviously it's a subject that you're passionate about, but you're obviously very passionate about Stehini as well. So I think it's only fair that we give them some airtime, maybe just give us a high-level overview of the company and what the key projects are and why those commodities and jurisdictions as well, of course.
Yeah, I appreciate that. No, I'm very proud of Stehini. You know, we formed it privately in 2017. We listed in 2019. Stehini was formed because co-founder Barry Hanslet is a very, very bright businessman. He invented the A5 drill rig, which is the most popular portable diamond rig. And I took Barry fly fishing as a teenager. He was a good mail order customer in 1991. We've been buddies ever since. And, you know, Barry called me up over the years for almost like an older brother type, and, you know, and he knows I'm experienced. And he said, what do you think? You know, I'm going to sell my placer operation. And what do you think? And what's the price? And he said, oh, these guys are going to offer me like $22 million at the time. I said, take the money, which he did. And he called me up in 2015 or 16. He said, Dave, I'm going to buy the big ADNAC molybdenum deposit up near Athlone. I was doing the reclamation work and it's available. And the markets are dead right now. And I can buy it for $2.5 million. And I said, well, man, if you can wait that out until the next cycle, you can make a fortune because that's like a world-class deposit. And so much money's already been spent on it. And we formed Stehini just because I said, listen, you get all the deals on your desk. You have access to deal flow. I know how to evaluate stuff. We both run good businesses. We're both ethical. We should form a mining company. That was sort of the genesis. I had no idea we were going to get Ruby Creek. And it just so happened that he had this project that he'd sold to the Chinese for $25 million US. And when the Huawei executive was detained in Canada, that China-Sino-Canadian relations sort of soured and that deal fell south. He received some non-refundable deposits and thought he'd sell it. And we lended that into Tahini. So our key asset is our Ruby Creek project, and it's in Atlin, BC. It's in northern BC. We actually fly from Vancouver, a two-hour flight to Whitehorse, and drive like an hour and three quarters back south into BC to get to Atlin. It's road accessible. Back in the day, a company called ADNAC Molybdenum was advancing the project. And during the last cycle, the molybdenum stocks did quite well. They actually had a big run from 2003 to 2007. But this was the one project that advanced the most. It went through the definition of the resource, went through feasibility, with positive feasibility, went through permitting, the native approval, and mine construction began. It was fully funded. They had a market cap at one point that maxed out, according to Larry Rea, the former chairman, maxed out $300 million. And they had an $800 million credit facility arranged to build a mine, and then construction began. And we have that project now, and we're a little $16 million company. On top of that, molybdenum, when we got the project a couple of years ago, molybdenum was $758 a pound. Now it's 19 and change. So we believe it's economic. It's, I've compared it to all the other deposits out there. It's one of the biggest and one of the best. And I truly believe it'll stand up to anything. Possibly, obviously, Freeport, McMoRan with their projects, Colorado, the Climax projects, is a bit of a freak of a deposit, but it's got 4 years of mine life left. So we're really excited, and that's our marquee deposit. But what's interesting about our Ruby Creek project is it's 28,000 hectares. It's very large, and the molybdenum deposit is still permitted. We have a Mines Act permit in place, but that's only 9,000 hectares of the 28,000 and change. So the other, we're sitting in the heart of what's called the Atlantic Gold Camp, and the largest placer operations in Canada today are literally happening under 10 years. Now, we don't have the placer rights, and the placer rights is not the domain for junior miners. We have the hard rock rights, and there's been several bedrock discoveries whereby the placer operators are excavating the gravels, and there might be 100 feet of gravel overburden the bedrock, but all the gold pay is within typically within a meter of the bedrock. But there's been some hard rock discoveries underneath. Plus, we found, we recently put a news release out indicating we found intrusion gold, porphyry type gold, much lower grade, but that's where the big money is. That's what the big boys want. They want the big bulk tonnage deposits. And there's also volcanic gold around too. And we've had some spectacular silver results. Last year, we had a discovery called Silver Surprise, whereby we had a sample. There's a prospect. We have one of our prospectors, Andrew Wilkins, a really bright guy, and he found this sample. We knew it was a bit different because it wasn't your galena, typical silver lead galena type veins we were founding near the molybdenum deposit. It was more of a sulfosalt. And it came back to the lab at, 14,000 gram per ton, which is 1.4% silver. And we're like, wow. And of course, we at the end of the season, so Hassan was up there, and one of our geophysicists, she was a PhD, geochemist, pardon me. They went at the end of the year and just spent half a day in there and traced the structure for 170 meters and found several samples, I believe 11 to 12 or well over 1,000 gram. And this year, I can't say much, but we were in that same area and we're finding all kinds more silver. And no one really cares about that, but really, we have a very advanced molybdenum project. And again, if I can, typically, these things should trade at about 1% of in situ value. And again, if I have a project that we're updating the resource now, the resource that we have on our molybdenum project is I'm looking at my deck right now as I'm talking to you, but the historical resource, which was last done in 2009 by Golder, had 407.9 million pounds of molybdenum measured and indicated and another 53 million inferred. And if you take that, those two numbers, even the measured and indicated, you convert to Canadian dollars and $19 and change US molybdenum, you have a project worth about $10 billion. And 1% of $10 billion is $100 million. And that should be, I believe, our minimum value. And right now we're trading with a $16 million market cap. I think it's extremely attractive. We've also got a really nice share structure. We have 25.9 million shares outstanding right now. We have 43% insider held. And myself and company co-founder Barry Hanslett, and we've been blessed to have Eric Sprott, the three of us have 40% of the company. So our money's where our mouth is, and it's a climax type deposit. It's very, very clean environmentally. Molybdenum is a metal of the future. It's a steel additive. Every car you see going by and every motor block and every drill bit has molybdenum. Of course, steel is iron and carbon and other, but the main alloy is molybdenum. But also, they've just talked that molybdenum batteries are going to be a big breakthrough in batteries, four times the electrical capacity of your standard lithium batteries. It's experimental still. And we don't want to put the, we've also got a really nice nickel project in Manitoba. We got a zinc, we got other projects as well. We don't pay for these projects. We either stake them ourselves, we buy them when they're out of favor. We don't chase stuff. And that's how you build a company. I believe that Barry and I know understand valuations very well. And we're very shrewd and we're doing stuff. We're working on some stuff right now behind the scenes too that I can't talk about. But again, we're trying to get something for nothing and we're pretty shrewd. We're not going to chase and buy stuff when it's out of favor. So that's our little company. And we have a web, Stuhini Exploration. Stuhini.com is a website. And our symbol is STU in the venture. And anyone ever wants to give me a call or have a Zoom meeting or want to learn more, I'm more happy to go over it. And I like teaching investors too how to invest and what to look for and what skin in the game really does mean as opposed to cheap stock or would you pay for it. And also all our projects are road accessible. We had a really nice project in the Golden Triangle called the Metla project. And we priced a road out. Two of us have road building experiences with $280 million. And then meanwhile, our Ruby Creek project, when we're in Atlanta, it's 14 kilometers of paved road to get to our project. It's another 20 kilometers from there to the Molly Pit because the big tenders. But the road alone, when ADNOC was building the mine under construction, the road alone cost $22 million. And you can drive a Honda Civic right to the site. We always have natives that are already permitted as well. So it's a special project. And again, that's a junior you can bite into it. Our VPX is San Salmabadi. I've known Hassan for years. I taught him to fly fish when he was a teenager. And he was really surprised when I got Ruby Creek, and he knew the senior geologist back in the day of the Ruby Creek project, and realized, wow, that's something they can bite their teeth into. That's something that's very, very real. And here you have a project that's already had, 339 drill holes, 69,000 meters of drilling, and been through feasibility. And Steve Darling recently asked me in an interview, he goes, Dave, what are your exploration plans? I go, well, exploration's all been done. You know, it's all been done. And doing the resource update, we have this incredible company, MDA from Nevada. They're one of the best in the world. And Steve Ruccicelli is our geologist. He's world renowned. But they have to review all the old drill data. We have most of the holes, and they randomly sample some holes. They showed up on site, and we laid all the holes out. They logged them, made sure those numbers matched the assays. Then they go on site and verify the collar location. They don't have to do any drilling, and the resource update is just about complete. Then we'll have our own resource. It isn't done by somebody else. And these guys are very good mine builders too, so really understand the deposit real well and digitize all the data and every modern database. We're excited about that. So we're expecting to have that resource update done within about a month. And behind the scenes, we have a Chinese broker working for us, and we're developing contacts in China and talking to larger mining companies. And I truly believe something strategic can happen. We're a bit of a sitting duck. And again, we don't have to worry about someone, even if it was going to give someone 19.9% of our shares. We're so tightly held, no one's going to take a run at us. And there's so few shares out there. So there you have our story in a nutshell.
Yeah, no, and obviously having Eric Sprott on your share register as well is a big tick for a lot of people as well.
Yeah, Eric's a smart guy. He does his homework. But I think he's actually there for the gold, right? We're in the Atlan Gold Camp. He's involved in all the companies. And that's we believe it's an emerging gold camp. The only problem we're having right now, we're stuck between two worlds, because my precious metals investors, my silver and gold investors, are like, why are you drilling for gold and silver? And my response is, why would you be worried about me hitting a couple of meters of 2,500 gram silver when I've got a $10 billion molybdenum deposit sitting there with an incredibly low strip ratio, shallow open pit deposit ready to go? That's where the value is. And we don't want to dilute our stock right now by doing greenfields exploration. So we're looking at all possibilities, including possibly breaking the company up or doing some sort of plan or arrangement. But we're just talking to their lawyer and our legal team about different options, and even the molybdenum deposit. We're sort of doing a strategic review right now of everything, how we want to move forward. And we've got a lot of good ideas. There's a lot of really exciting things. Keep an eye out there, because a lot of catalysts are brewing behind the scenes. But we're very excited.
Excellent. All right, that seems like quite a good point, maybe just to call it a day for this podcast anyway, Dave, because that's almost 55 minutes, Mark. You're the man with the time.
Yeah, we're up on about 55 minutes, yeah. And what a great snapshot of the company there at the end, Dave. So thank you for that. I'll be looking into that a bit more, and maybe we can have you on again to maybe just focus on the company and the news flow and what's coming. But thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. I want to ask you one final question. And what is your, just general on the markets, what's your short-term outlook on the? And when I say short-term, I mean like in the next year. How do you see things going? You're obviously still bullish on the commodities, but what do you see something significant happening either way?
Yeah, I think that as we discussed earlier, the Fed has no choice but to inflate. And so we're going to see continued inflation. These numbers aren't going to get much better. And if you believe it's temporary, I believe we're wrong. No, they risk by tightening up too much. They do risk a deflationary spiral. They don't want that scenario. But I believe that the best way to buy inflation, especially now, is to play commodities. And I think that, again, molybdenum is a great space to be in. Copper is a good space. Precious metals is a given. Even oil and gas. But again, buy good companies, big reserves, are well run, place clean balance sheets. But make sure they got tangible real assets, because that's a great way to remember, things are priced in terms of dollars, and dollars with inflation become worth a lot less. If you want to buy things that are real and can't be printed, and I think that that's a great way to play going forward. And I think that the stock market right now, we see things like Bitcoin and these FANG stocks are priced. I generally don't buy companies at more than a 10 multiple, and you got companies not trading at 10 times earnings, trading at more than 10 times revenue. That's stratospheric. It's like the 1999 tech bubble. I got out of that a year early, and a lot of my friends thought I was a fool. I sold all my technology stocks. This doesn't make sense anymore. It always comes back to basics. I don't care what people always say, fundamentals and basics. You buy low PE companies, big reserves in the ground with good management. And don't worry about everyone's chasing hot sectors or buying fangs. And people buying these stocks don't even know what a PE multiple is. And you want to go back to your textbooks and open up in the good old base. I still see some great value out there. Keep away from the ballooned out sectors. And we're going to see these deflate. We're going to see these stocks go back to maybe trade at 20 or 30 multiples of earnings, but not over 100. I mean, how can Tesla be worth 10 times the value of Toyota when Toyota sells 10 times the vehicles? And Like, I drive Toyotas and I'd never sell my Toyota to buy a Tesla. It's just, again, it's pie in the sky chasing stuff that I think you got to go back and look at your resources is the best way to play this.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Dave. Yeah, thank you very much for your time. And
thank you so much, gentlemen. I think the only sad part about this podcast is we didn't get into fishing. I mean, our priorities are they should be, but
yeah, definitely. We'll save that for another time, Dave. And we'll need to make sure I've got a beer in my hand as well, because fishing and drinking go hand in hand. Well, and manic, they would.
I never heard of that. Really. Do things differently over there, you know.
Yeah, maybe a podcast, Kenny, with you discuss the stocks and fishing at the same time with the beer in hand. Maybe that's a new program.
Well, maybe, you know, every fall I'm up in Smithers steelhead fishing, and we can just do a podcast from Smithers. You know, I can even bring my PC to the banks of the river, and you know, and we can talk about it. But I also like talking about I think it's really important to teach investors about investing, about being careful with management, knowing what projects are, and digging deep and not getting trapped and doing some careful, because what scares me more than anything about this, the mining stuff, is, you know, in 2020, a year and a half ago, we had a really good run in the mining stocks, and I was shaking my head because all the scumbag, you know, promoters and Moose Pasture Project are the ones that soared, because they know how to, you know, pay off the newsletter writers and how to do a greasy marketing campaign and how to trick people. And we want to make sure that, and then those people, of course, they get duped. And they buy a worthless project, the stock collapses later. And then they I don't want to buy mining stocks. And they got to do better than that. Don't just ride the wave and be tricked by fancy marketing campaigns, and dig deep into what these companies actually have for projects and make sure they're real projects and make sure management's got a track record, you know, and that they're putting shareholders above their needs. Their salaries are reasonable. And I used to go straight to the MD&A. And now I look at the information circuit because I want to know who the shareholders are and what their salaries are and who has insider positions. Then I'll look at the MD&A and then I'll phone up the company and start doing some homework.
Perfect.
Yep. Oh, well, thanks very much for your time, Dave.
Enjoy your evening in the UK there, and I'm going to get started my day here in Vancouver.
Yeah, super. Okay. Well, you have a good rest of your day. Thank you for getting up for us.
Definitely. Okay, right. Thanks so much. Okay. Cheers, Dave. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Dave. Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.